How will you disrupt yourself? How will you disrupt yourself? How will you disrupt yourself?
Welcome to the Disrupt Yourself podcast, a podcast where we discuss strategies and advice for how to climb the S-curve of learning in your professional and personal life, disrupting who you are now to slingshot into who you want to be. I'm your host, Whitney Johnson, and today our guest is Sandy Stelling, Vice President of Strategy, Analytics, and Transformation at Alaska Airlines. In late 2019, I heard Sandy speak at the Drucker Forum in Vienna. I immediately thought, you all need to hear from her. You need to hear her story. A 20-year veteran of Alaska Airlines, Sandy is fluent in the language of growth, of jumping from one S-curve of learning to the next. And so we set it up. In early March of 2020, I interviewed Sandy and we had a lovely conversation. And then the pandemic hit the United States. Alaska Airlines, with so many others, pretty much everyone else in the industry, was hit hard and fast, a never-before-seen disruption. Something told me, press pause, don't release the interview right now, take a step back. So that's what we did. Recently, I reconnected with Sandy to get an update. So what you're going to hear in this conversation today is a fusion of those two interviews. What's most striking to me is that across both, despite the pandemic, despite a global industry upending event, is Sandy's optimism. It is ever present. Sandy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Whitney. It's great to be here with you today.
You were so good at the Drucker Forum, as I just said. I wanted to learn more about you and what you do. So will you start by telling us about where you grew up and what you wanted to be?
Sure. So I was born in New York City and two parents, one from Brooklyn and one as a dairy farmer.
I didn't see that one coming.
I was raised in New Jersey. And from there, I went to school at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania and made my way cross country to Seattle, where I live now. And when I was a kid growing up, I always wanted to travel. I didn't know what the job looked like. I wanted to travel. And then as I got older, I was led to believe that all kids grow up in New Jersey and go to work in Manhattan, even though I didn't know what you did there. That was just, you got on the train and you went to Manhattan. But really, when I started to find my own dreams, it was I wanted to be an astronaut.
So how old were you when you thought you wanted to be an astronaut?
Probably when I was in middle school and high school. Definitely was working hard towards it, if you can, when you're 14. Worshipped Sally Ride. Found a pen pal who had been as part of the shuttle program. Started writing him letters, having him send me pictures.
So what did you study in college then, since that's what you knew you wanted to do?
Yeah, so I was going down a path to go to the Air Force Academy because that's what I understood the road was. I was 16 and got glasses and had to change those plans because you couldn't fly in the Air Force then. So I became a mechanical engineer. And that was the degree that I got, my undergraduate degree.
Were you interested in engineering before you started school? I mean, if you'd gone to the Air Force Academy, would you have still studied engineering, or was that a pivot as well for you?
I was fortunate to grow up in a neighborhood and with teachers who were very encouraging and who maybe saw things in me that I didn't recognize. My parents didn't even know what engineers were. Neither did I. So I said, I'm going to go be an engineer. And they were like, you're going to what? They're like, can you get a job? I go, I think so. That sounds good. But a lot of supportive. I loved physics. I loved calculus, things that are far reaching for me today. A lot of encouragement from teachers and others to pursue engineering. And once I got into school, I just loved it. What I learned is I love to build. Hmm. And that had been with me since I was little. I mean, I was the Legos kid. I love to draw architectural diagrams. I'm sounding like an ultimate nerd right now.
It's awesome. I love it so much. So, Sandy, is there a teacher or a couple of teachers when you were in high school that you want to give a shout out to?
Yeah, one of them is, this is maybe kind of silly, I'm Facebook friends with my freshman and sophomore high school math teacher. I don't know how not normal that is, but common that is. Mr. Dan Caffrey, he was very encouraging. You know, as a girl at the time, being good at math or liking math.
So unusual. That,
yeah, it was never, but I never felt odd about it or odd man out about it. It was very encouraged and supported. So I didn't know that that was a thing until later on in my career, honestly. I had a professor, Way, when I was in college. And he probably left the most indelible impression on me, because you talk to people who've been very successful in academics, they go through school, and eventually they're going to struggle. But when I was in college, I was struggling and I was frustrated. I couldn't get the answers right, and it just made me crazy. And I went in his office and I was pounding my fist and I was like, why can't I get the answers right? And he says, you're not here to get the answer right. And I was like, excuse me? I know a whole bunch of people that would disagree with that statement. I am here at college to get the right answer. And he says, no. I was like, okay. He goes, you're here to learn how to learn. Head explodes. And I was like, wow. So I'm going to still disagree with him for a while. And then I realized, okay, maybe he's right. Maybe he's onto something. And he really sent me on a different trajectory from that point forward.
Wow. That is so moving. It actually almost brings me to tears, because it's just so powerful.
Yeah. I hope everybody has teachers like that.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Unfortunately, he passed away a couple of years ago. But I know that he must have had that impact on a lot of students.
All right. You graduated from college. What was your first job out of college?
So I was a mechanical systems test engineer for the Boeing company. The day I graduated, my dad says, you've got 30 days to get out of the house. And I think he was kidding. I got in my Volkswagen and I drove 3,000 miles cross country and started my job in Seattle at Boeing. I was there from 1991 to 1999.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay. Alaska Airlines, where you have spent now the bulk of your career. You go to Alaska as a project manager for your very first job there. What does a project manager do? Because it's one of those jobs that I think we are hearing more and more about, but don't have a great sense of what it is one does.
Yeah, so as the project manager role that I stepped into, we were responsible for the IT infrastructure. A lot of it was supporting growth even from that point. We would start operating in a new city. So we were going to start flying to Tucson. We were going to start flying to Washington Reagan. As the project manager for the IT team, we were part of the advanced team to go set up and define the plan and what had to be executed so that we could start our operations in those locations.
Oh, okay. That's very clear. And it was your job just to make sure everybody did all their different pieces, played their role properly, kind of like directing it or producing it almost.
Yeah, it was sort of like producing a show. What was interesting was coming into the organization in this area, I think from a maturity curve was pretty new. And so I said, okay, so where's the checklist of what we have to do this? And there wasn't one. I'm like, well, okay, so let's build that. Let's find a process to get us through this. And I was leveraging the experiences I had at Boeing as an engineer, where you were an engineer, but you were leading essentially projects. You were leading work from inception through completion. Whether it's at the ideation stage, to scoping and design, to planning and execution, to ultimate delivery and outcome. We were doing that sort of work as an engineer day to day at the Boeing company, and I was just translating it into a different language when I came to Alaska. When I took that job at Alaska, so this would have been 1999, and I was looking for a change from Boeing. I'd been there a little over 8 years, and I just was anxious to do something else. So Alaska Airlines is right down the road. What was interesting was the job I took was in the IT department, and I remembered the interview. They said, what do you know about technology? I'm like, well, and they go, what do you know about computers? I'm like, this is 1999. I'm like, well, I've used them. And they said, what else do you know? I said, not a lot. Candidly, I don't. And they said, well, we need a project manager for computers and IT stuff. And I said, well, to me, it's just different stuff. I worked on aircraft hydraulics and flight controls and landing gear. And now you're saying I have bits and bytes and routers and servers. It's same, same. And they were like, are you sure? I go, I think so. So what was happening, it was before the dot boom went dot bust. And so project managers in the Seattle area, people who could drive execution and technology, was a pretty slim resource. So I think Alaska and I kind of came to terms of like, let's take a chance on each other and see how this goes. So we did, and it's been great.
Okay, so I'm going to talk through your various roles for our listeners. You can also look at her LinkedIn profile, which we'll include in the show notes. But here's what it is, and I'll tick them off really quickly. Project manager to airport services, to customer experience R&D, to process engineering, to business transformation, to strategy and transformation. Could you then talk through us at a very high level what you did in each of these roles, and then something that you learned in the role that's made it possible for you to do what you're doing now?
Yeah, so I touched already, I think, on the project manager job that I stepped into. But as I was discussing working with the airports, what was amazing, it was the airline industry is incredibly complicated, which is also what gets me out of bed every day. And to learn how the airline operated from that perspective was an education like none other. Because I was introduced to all of the different functions that make the airline operate and all of the different people involved that make the airline operate. So whether it was pilots or aircraft technicians or customer service agents or leaders, I had access and opportunity to learn from all of the different groups. And candidly, you'll see the pattern that develops here. I'll kind of cut to the chase or spoiler alert is as a systems engineer, that's how my brain is wired to work. So I just kept storing all the information I was gathering to create this mosaic of the airline. From there, I had the opportunity to go into airport services, which is not a natural progression, I'll be honest. And what happened there was I had the opportunity to apply everything I had learned and make the experience better for the employees that work at the airport. I was responsible for their procedures, for their technology, working in close partnership with our IT team, as well as with our training team. So I learned a lot about training from the experts that I had the privilege to lead, but I also got to continue to fill in the mosaic or the puzzle or the picture, if you will, of how the airline operates. The big transition there was it really became more about people and less about technology. And so that was a big growing spurt for me, especially someone who had been trained as an engineer and thought to be very technical, recognizing that your success isn't always about the thing you produce, but how you produce it and how people come with you on those journeys. You know, I want to insert one in there. I spent 3 years in our maintenance organization. And the reason I want to insert this one is because it was probably the most radical change.
Oh, all right. Tell us all about it.
Yeah. So I went from the airports team to the maintenance team, and I was asked to go there by our COO. They wanted me to go take a role in the maintenance team. The ask of me was to restructure part of our organization in maintenance to get the cost structure right while maintaining safety and delivery for the airline. What was phenomenal about it was the vice president of airports took me to lunch. He'd been here 30 years. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I was asked to take the job in maintenance. Seems like a good job. Seems like there's work to be done. I like to be of service. I want to make a difference." He goes, "I've been here 30 years. No one does that." "What do you mean no one does that?" He goes, "No one's ever done that. Nobody goes to maintenance." And I was like, okay. Well, first time for everything.
Yeah. So it was a very counterintuitive move, is what you're saying.
Yeah. The organization was a little surprised. Mm-hmm. But it was a great learning experience. And the relationships I built there continue to be invaluable to me today. Moving into customer R&D, this was an opportunity I had to propose a role for myself, if you will.
Oh.
There was a lot of changes going on, and they said, "Well, what role do you want to play?" And they'd identified a couple roles they were going to fill, and I said, "Well, I think you guys have a gap, and here's the gap, and I'd love the opportunity to fill it." And they were like, "That makes sense. Okay, you can go do that." And I said, "Great." Again, my need to build.
Yep.
I was able to build our customer analytics and insights and some of our innovation programs to find new ways to change the guest experience over time. Mm-hmm. So the most devastating part was 3 years later, I had to shut down the innovation program.
Oh.
And kind of a gut puncher. But it was at the same time that we decided to acquire Virgin America. And I think smartly, the airline said, "Okay, we can't do everything at one time." The president said, "Hey, we need you to go work on the merger." And I like to answer questions with questions. So I'm like, "What do you want me to do there?" And they go, "You'll figure it out." And I was like, I'll figure it out. So start diving into the merger work and realize, wow, there is a lot of people, process, technology that has to be brought together in a certain sequence of events to make this work for people. And how do you mitigate all the risks along the way? As we were getting our arms around the work, the largest piece of an airline integration is the reservation system, because that's where all the customer reservations exist. Mm-hmm. And how you cut that over, well or not well, really communicates to basically the entire globe how you did on your merger.
Oh, interesting.
Because that every customer sees it, right? Whether the airports are right, the websites are right, your tickets work or don't work, And we had had evidence of airlines that had preceded us in activities like this that hadn't gone well. Mm-hmm. So we knew what bad looked like. And we were like, okay, we don't want to do that. And so they asked me to take that on. And you'll see a pattern is I'm always like, well, I don't know how to do that. Oh, you'll figure it out. Okay, we'll go figure it out. So we went and figured it out. And that led to the merger that we completed for all of our guest-facing systems in April of 2018. Hmm. You basically cut over one airline into the other airline on a single night.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's no risk, no big deal, right? No, handfuls of sleepless nights, but super rewarding that our team executed flawlessly. And I couldn't have been more proud of what everybody did.
In reading the press reports, I mean, it was really a model of integration. Mm-hmm. When you think about this, if for people who are listening, who are going through some type of merger or acquisition, need to integrate what they've acquired, do you have some practical advice, even if it's a little bit in the weeds, for people who are trying to integrate a new company into their organization?
Yeah, a couple of things that come to mind when I think about that, Whitney. One is you have to make sure that as an organization, you not only set out goals that you're going to be aligned on, but you continually check in that you're still aligned to those goals. Mm. There's always the risk of the drift.
Yeah.
Other agendas could creep in, other priorities could sneak their way in. So it's how do you make sure that the goals that you're working towards are front and center every day, all the time, no doubt, no miscommunication, no misunderstanding. And I think that's one that I would say was really important, specifically for the work that I was leading. We had three very simple goals. One was set up our employees to be successful. Mm-hmm. Make this a non-event for our guests. Like we really believe if our guests didn't know we did this, we win. Yep. And the third one, which sometimes became the first one when we were joking, was the CEO is not on the news apologizing. And so those are kind of three mantras that were very simple, but were galvanizing and everyone could relate to. Mm-hmm. That we would just keep bringing, you know, beat that drum day after day, week after week. The other one that I would encourage people to think about if you're leading an effort like this is you have to create, and I found this really important, a safe space so that everyone can participate and be part of solving the problem or problems. I mean, in our case, the industry is so complex. There's no one person who's going to have all the answers to make this fit, to make this work. So by creating a safe space where everyone could come and explore the issues, collaborate and solve problems, and then creating an environment from that point forward where they could prepare and they could build and they could also build their confidence in the work that they were doing, I think was really important and something that we were very intentional about.
Is there one specific moment or event that you can think of where you did create that safe space in problem solving that you can point to?
Yeah, we had a couple areas. The interesting thing about a reservation system, and not to discourage anyone from air travel, it's complex, but we've got it handled, right? Is that a customer's reservation actually affects every part of the airline. Like there isn't anybody who's immune, if you will, from the changes that we were about to make. So I remember we met with our maintenance team and we said, hey, we think there's some work you guys have to take on to prepare for this change. And they're like, no, we're okay. And I'm like, let's explore this together. So we invited them in with a team of folks. We talked about different scenarios and we created a space where they actually discovered the work that they were going to have to take on and do. Again, how do we set our employees up for success? How do we make this a non-event for guests? And how do we keep the CEO out of the news? They were like, yeah, we have work to do.
Sounds like what you were willing to do is for people who were sort of wanting to believe that they didn't, you know, everything was just going to just work out. You were gently saying, it will work out if we talk about it. So let's just talk about it. Let's explore it. Let's name it. And once we name it, then people got their sort of brain started to activate and say, oh, we can solve this. We can figure this out. Does that sound like what the experience that you created?
Yeah, I think the way I oversimplify it, just in like counting on three fingers, is like, how do you build the village or community that have shared beliefs and values and goals? Then how do you share the problem with the group so everyone can participate? And then how do you collectively work the problem?
Okay.
And so I always say build the village, share the problem, work the problem. And I think that part of what was really important of something of that scale was how do you give the transparency to the decisions that are made, the process that you're operating in, the progress that's being made in execution. Because I think a lot of project managers and leaders in general come into the role as like command and control. And I think that's a very dated model. And I knew early at the outset, given the complexity of this, there's no way that model would even stand a day.
Yeah.
And I told our executives, I said, here's the deal. I don't have command and control of this thing. My goal is to influence and guide. And I kind of had this mental model of back when we were kids, you had this like giant earth ball in the playground and everyone would like shove it around, like you'd nudge it. I don't know. It was like 10 kids to move this thing. And that's what I felt like I was doing. Can I just shove the thing to the left, shove the work to the right, bring people together and create an environment where all this work could get done? Because there was no individual or even small team that was going to be able to pull this off. It was going to take everybody.
Yeah. So walk us through just at a very high level, touch each of those pieces of your career that you've had, how they've all contributed to your being able to do what you're doing today.
This is like a therapy moment.
I'm sorry. I'm just,
oh,
I think it's
good.
So interesting. It's and cool. People love it.
Well, I think when you're busy doing it, you don't always realize what you're doing, right? So it's a great step back moment. I have been a hungry learner with probably too much energy my entire life. The roles have come because I'm continually learning and apply the learning and just continue to turn that crank. And, when you talk about different sort of like change curves and learning curves, I just look at mine as perpetually uphill and I'll never get to the top.
Yep.
And I think that insatiable appetite, as well as like loading up the backpack of all my learnings, I just continue to pay it forward. I think that with the merger, it really felt like a culmination of the career that I had up until that point. Ironically, until I got this job, now this job feels like the culmination of the last 20 years. I think that's just perpetuating. It's just continuing. You just take the last X number of years and add on, finding ways to navigate change and helping us do it more consistently is leveraging all of those experiences I've had, because there were some things along the way that didn't go so great, like shutting down innovation or some other projects where you learn some painful lessons. But all of that coming together and being able to teach while we do is where I'm at now.
So good. So Sandy, we spoke earlier this year, and since then there has been a global pandemic, which has obviously impacted the airlines significantly. Just what's it been like?
Yeah, you'd like me to sit back and say, oh, no big deal, piece of cake, we've seen this before. And I think the reality is we haven't seen this before. And I've been here now over 21 years. So working at Alaska Airlines, we survived an aircraft accident with loss of life. We survived and endured through 9/11. We survived and worked through the recession in 2008, 2009. And then when this pandemic set in, it sort of came up as a combine all three, then add 2x, 3x, 5x, and this is the situation we found ourselves in. But the initial move was immediate crisis response and triage and safety. And everybody galvanized their own safety. So whether it's safety for employees, safety for guests, that was where all of the energy went until we felt we had, got a little bit of footing there. And then we did do a divide and conquer across all the other aspects of our company to ensure that we can preserve and protect the organization and do what we could to best support our people.
It's really interesting to hear you say we went through all these, different crises in the company, and you there's this pattern recognition. What's one specific thing that you did when you saw, okay, we've seen this movie before, at least sort of perhaps the trailer of this film before? What's something that you did?
For my role, I had spent, and this was the part that also was like a little party died inside, was we had spent the 8 months prior to COVID building our company's five-year strategy. And it was exciting and it was very growth-oriented. And we had spent the month of January touring around the country, sharing it with our employees. So we came into this on a high. And I think it made the crashing into the low like that much more painful. And for me, I had led the effort for the company to develop the strategy with a pretty decentralized approach, with me really holding the complexity and the comprehensive strategy together. What happened when this set upon us, I was like, oh my gosh, how are we going to organize and keep everybody connected? What I did is I reached out to our executive leadership team and said, you know, is there something I can do to help here? And they were first like, we're not sure. And I said, okay, well, let me just join you. And then within a matter of days, I was like, okay, I see where I plug in here. And we put together what we called work streams, which really was just like the major lines of business or parts of the organization that we had to make sure we focused on. We assessed the situation, we developed the action plan, and we drove the actions through execution. And so I sort of ran the, or led and facilitated the discussions that were occurring in the war room, you know, to say, look, this guy's, what's next? And then which things have reached stability and can move on, which things have to be moved on to the docket and be considered now because their time has come. And so I found myself sort of in this air traffic control, to use an airline metaphor, like place of more of this, less of this. We haven't talked about this. Hey, this is coming fast. We have a milestone coming up ahead. We need to hit this, which is sort of it's my sweet spot, but I had never done it at scale under this duress. So that was the new part, but it was skills that I innately brought to the table that allowed them to all stay in their lanes and do what they needed to do, but creating a framework and a forum for them to operate in.
Interesting. So what you're saying is that you had this experience of being a figurative air traffic controller that allowed you to navigate through this. What experience in your past gave you that skill? I always think it's interesting, you know, when we get into a crisis situation and we manage through it, there's something that we've done in the past, at least once, that prepared us to do that. Is there something in your career or in your life growing up that prepared you? First of all, say, what do you need? They said, all right, well, we're not sure. Then you observed and said, okay, here's what I think you need. And then you stepped in and did it. And what sounds like was important here is that people were not resentful when you stepped in and did it. So there's something that you were doing that allowed them to receive the direction from the air traffic controller. I know there's a lot in there, but let's see what bubbles up for you as I ask that string of questions.
One of the things I think, just simply put, is I did join Alaska Airlines as a project manager. And as I've moved up around and visited and worked in all parts of this organization, the idea of organizing teams around complex solutions and executing activities is something that I've been doing in various size, shapes, and forms for years. So I think that becomes almost instinctive for me. And I currently now lead our corporate project manager office, which is a great opportunity to mentor and develop, you know, next generations of people with those skills. So that, I think, is like the fundamentals. I think where you are getting at, and I like the perspective of how did they not resent me coming into this space, is I don't lead from a sense of control, which I think if you show up as like, I'm now in charge, I'm now in control, I haven't seen that land well for me. What I have been most effective at is saying, I'm actually here to support, I'm here to help, and I'm here to guide. And it's not taking away anybody else's authority or responsibility. And I think so it creates a space for everyone to be in at the same time. It's not pushing someone out to make room for me. Like, I'm not trying to jockey for space. So I think that's one piece that helps how you come into an environment like that is like, what's really your role? And your role is additive, not remove and replace.
So interesting. And if I remember correctly, you played soccer when you were younger, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So there's this fascinating thread for me as I watch this. So let me just observe for a second. So you played soccer when you're younger. You really know how to play on a team. Then you come to Alaska Airlines, you're a project manager, which requires by definition that you can coordinate and work with, you know, disparate people. And then now, in this moment of crisis, what people needed was someone who could help direct, to guide, to support, and you had been building that muscle your entire life. And that's fascinating to me. And now I want to make an observation, which I think is also interesting. I was just reading an article by Morten Hansen and Joel Podolny about how Apple is organized, and they're organized basically functionally versus business units. And one of the things that they said people have to be able to do in order to be successful at Apple is they have to be able to collaborate across areas. And what I hear you saying is there's that ability, that muscle that you had to develop as a project manager in order to collaborate, and that allowed you to step in this time of crisis.
Yeah, and I would add one thing, because I think if a project manager is listening to this, they're like, great, that's all I need. And I think there is a couple other ingredients that may be worth calling out. One of the other ones, my experience at Alaska, because I've worked in so many different parts of the company, because I've had access and exposure to so many parts mm-hmm. of the business, because of the leadership role I had through the merger with Virgin America that we talked about before, I also was fluent in many languages. So I was able to, you know, I can switch from a maintenance and engineering conversation to a airports conversation to a marketing commercial conversation. And I think having that knowledge and those relationships with those groups is super helpful in how you have to kind of navigate and bring folks together. The other thing that I think was it's a skill I have that I think has been honed over time. I don't know if you asked me 20 years ago, would you say, are you really good at this? I probably would have been, I don't know. But it has been reflected back to me, and I now see it in action. I saw it in action here. Is I'm very comfortable in ambiguity. I'm super comfortable jumping in if we don't know where we're going or what we're doing. That's okay. What do we know? And so where that really came into play was when they're like, well, what do we do now? I'm like, well, we're in charge. We can decide what makes sense, because there's times that some people just got stuck. And how, you know, and just being there as like shoulder to shoulder of like, let me just give you a nudge to get you unstuck. And then you just start throwing out options. Yeah. Well, you could go this way. You could do that. You can do this for the next 3 days and see what it looks like and then make the next decision, just to create movement, because so much was going on for people in their lives, you know, at work, at home, whatever it was, people got stuck. There were times I got stuck.
Sandy, what was one of those moments when you got stuck over the last 9 months?
For me, I got stuck at the beginning. I actually just sort of froze. And I, to your point, I started to observe because I didn't actually know what to do. And normally I would just lean into it and figure it out on the way. But I did take a couple weeks to really just observe what was happening and try to form a way that I could get a point of entry and contribute and make sense of it. But that was frustrating for me because I have such a strong desire to just want to move. I was ready to jump in. And I was like, I don't know that's going to be effective right now, because it'll just look like noise. So I had an internal frustration of like, you know, my brain was just trying to figure it out. Where do I go? How does it work? What do I do? There was a lot going on around me and I needed some help and support. You know, somebody came, you know, they nudged my shoulder and then knocked me loose. And I was like, okay, I can do this, which I think is good. I think that's a sign of a healthy team. You take turns, you know, bumping each other's shoulders.
What's been a proud moment when you look at your team or you look at your company and you just say, wow, look at what we did? Something come to mind?
I think for me personally, what I've been most proud of, I lead a team of project managers. In March, to preserve cash, we cut about 50% of the projects that were planned for the year. You know, tens of millions of dollars of investment to, you know, improve and grow the business we were going to spend. But we were very intentional, and I worked early on with the leaders to say, look, guys, these projects need to keep going. He's like, they're not sexy. They're actually not instrumental for the crisis response, but we're going to want them in our rearview mirror when we come out of this. Asking, can we as a company agree that these are going to remain priorities? We are going to keep them, we're going to resource them, and we're going to support these teams as they focus on getting this work done. And we all agreed to that. And the performance of my team to deliver on these projects in April, during the summer, in September, in October, the amount of work that they've been able to do and the work that they accomplished specifically positions us so much better for recovery and growth. I'm so proud of how they've positioned this company and stayed focused in spite of all of these distractions and all of this pain and all of this, just this. In addition to the pandemic, our company also, and like many others in society, racial injustices and inequities became, you know, in May and June, all this came and washed over us, and we're working very hard on that. And there's a lot of work to be done. We also had in the summer here on the West Coast wildfires that impacted our operations and our employees and our guests. We were going down a path of like, where are the locusts falling from the sky? Like, what else are we going to have to contend with as an airline in 2020? And so the fact that we had so many wonderful employees who were able to stay focused and do the good work is actually I think that's very cool.
Oh, I agree. And there's probably, you know, for this big story that you're telling, there might be, you know, probably hundreds, if not thousands, of individual stories that you could tell.
Yeah.
You know, my thesis is that the fundamental unit of growth in any organization is the individual. And so can you think of something that you did this year that you said, I'm going to disrupt myself. I'm going to step back from who I am and what I'm doing today so that I can slingshot forward. And as you started to change, you started to do something differently. Things and people changed around you that making it possible for Alaska Airlines to disrupt itself.
For me personally, I think the biggest thing is when I did start working with our executive team, I have worked with a number of them individually. I had worked with them on the strategy as a team over the last year, but that doesn't have the same sort of like stress and dynamic that this environment created.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I found myself doing different than I think what my typical MO would have been is I was definitely much more in an observer role because I knew, given the stress levels that everyone was under, myself included, is I had to make sure that I was, what a coach once told me is I was listening for more. Hmm. I've learned I have to listen for more. I have to hear what's said, but I have to also lean in and hear what's not said. You know, prior to this, I think I would do some of that, but often it came as reflective. Like after the meeting, you'd be like, oh yeah, now that makes sense. Oh, I can see it. You know, that kind of thing. Whereas in this case, I was in the room, it was happening, and I was like observing dynamics between people, observing a person who showed up maybe one way on Monday and a very different way on Tuesday, and doing it in a way that I knew none of it was personal, whatever was happening. Like, it wasn't about me. This one was really intentional, given the nature of the situation and all the players I was working with, to show up differently and be much more observant. And like I said, listen for more and see more.
We're toward the end of 2020, and when we air this, it's either going to be late 2020, early 2021. What is something that you have learned as you've been pushed off this S-curve, as we all have, something that you have learned, perhaps a grace that you have granted yourself that you hadn't previously, that you look at as a gift and you want to carry forward with you into 2021?
I think one of the big mantras that I've found, and I don't know that I was a practicer of this years ago, but I found myself often talking to my team, telling myself, people we're working with, is like, we've got to operate from a place that gives grace and space. You know, I would sign my emails that way. I would have my team meetings this way. This is a perfect time for everyone to just get down on themselves because nothing's working out the way they planned it. Everyone can see themselves as an individual colossal failure if they look back on their plans for 2020 and what they did for 2020. And I think that it's just the wrong mindset. The power of optimism, and maybe people call it hope. You could talk about it as potential, upside, silver lining, whatever sort of floats your boat on that. I think there's a big difference between, you know, the doubt or pessimism and the optimism. And I think sometimes people think ambiguity and uncertainty is doubt or pessimism. And I don't think those are true. I think that's very different. Because I can be optimistic and curious and hopeful in a land of ambiguity.
Absolutely. I love it. Optimism is not a function of certainty or ambiguity. Last question for you today is, you recently did an exercise. You said internally that you had to create a 6-word story that describes you. Will you tell us the 6-word story and the story behind the story?
Yeah, I'll say them and then I'll share how I got there. There are 3 phrases. One is mission motivated, excellence driven, and then all in. I think you heard from the work I did with the merger was setting missions for people that we share. Having goals instilled probably in me from birth with my parents, but being aligned around something bigger than yourself has always been a motivator for me, and I've seen it be an effective motivator with others. People want to be part of a community. People want to belong, and people want to contribute. And so identifying a mission where all that can be unlocked and unleashed is really important to me. Excellence driven comes from a place of learning that I think a number of us grew up with, like a perfectionist curse, and you're expected to be perfect and then you're not perfect. So there you're a failure. And it's this very binary all or nothing mindset. And this came from a place of feedback I got from other people. They said, you know, you don't demand perfection of course you're like stumped. You're like, sure I do. Of course I do. They're like, no, you demand excellence. So I actually explored that with this person and said, help me understand how that's different for you. And they said, you expect me to give you the best that I can, but you recognize that it may not be perfect. And I was like, okay, that's fair. You're right. That's what I do.
Yep.
And it's the same I do for myself. And I've learned over the years, yeah, I'm not perfect. I'm a hot mess like everybody else. But it doesn't mean I can't get out of bed every day and try really, really hard. And so I think that's where the excellence driven comes in. And all in, it speaks to a couple things, but I don't know what kind of language you can have on these, Whitney. I can't do anything half-assed. Probably we could edit different words there, but I, after 32 years, had to stop playing soccer, competitive soccer, because the doctor said, you can keep playing and here's the list of surgeries you'll have, or you can play at these other levels. And I'm like, I can't play halfway. You know, so the choice was to step off the field. Now I can run and do all the other things. I just couldn't do that thing that I loved, but because halfway wasn't going to work.
Yeah.
I think I approach my work the same way. I approach the people I care for the same way. I'm just, life's too short and I'm all in.
So good. Sandy Stelling, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Whitney.
There's something special about Sandy Stelling. She has this off-the-charts lateral awareness. The success of an organization or an individual isn't found in managing up and down. It lies in the ability to play sideways. Talking with Sandy, you can tell she gets this down deep with every team that she leads, every project that she manages. In our framework of personal disruption, we have 7 accelerants. The 5th is to battle entitlement. And when Sandy is looking and playing sideways, she's battling her sense of entitlement. The 7th accelerant is to be driven by discovery. If you look back at each of Sandy's roles, every time she jumped to a new S-curve, she was taking a step forward, gathering feedback, and adapting. Fast forward 2 short years to a global pandemic, being discovery-driven has become even more crucial. The executive search firm Korn Ferry did a study to come up with the leading predictors of C-suite success. And they said, yeah, technical skills, you've got to have them, but that's table stakes. What you really need is this ability to deal with ambiguity, to just walk into the unknown. That's a skill we've always needed, and it's always held a person in good stead. But in 2020, that skill became 10 times, possibly 100 times more valuable. A willingness to say, well, I don't know, but let's move and we'll figure it out. I love that Sandy is so comfortable with ambiguity. She epitomizes this idea that if you want to be an agent of change, first become its subject. As we begin to close out the year, I want you to think about the past experiences you've had that have helped you navigate 2020. You may very well realize that you're better at thriving in ambiguity than you've thought. Then I want you to think about the experiences you have this year that are going to help you next year, that are going to help you figure 2021 out. Thank you again to Sandy Stelling for being with us, not once, but twice. And a huge thank you to my team, Jennifer Brotherson, Whitney Jobe, Steve Ludwig, Melissa Ruddy, and Nancy Wilson. I'm Whitney Johnson, and this is Disrupt Yourself.